So I guess you are going to be the sole beneficiary of this information.
At least for a few minutes, anyway.
That's true. That's true. Budgeting. Budgeting. The state budget process. As I'm sure you know, everything costs money.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for the government to provide the services that residents demand, the government must tax us, take our money, and basically pay for the salaries, the services, any like necessary capital items that are deliverables. Everything costs money. And by the Constitution, by state law, the state annually must produce a document that says what we're going to spend and where we're going to spend the money. Although, interestingly enough, we are the only state out of all 50 that does not require the budget to be posted publicly. Unlike towns, cities and towns by state law have to post their budgets. So if you go to a small town like in Sutton, we have our town meeting coming up, all of the people who attend town meeting will get a budget book, and they will get a document that shows every single penny that was spent and where it was spent on. Salaries, utilities, vehicles, equipment, all of it's contained in there. Because ultimately, the state can't spend more money than it takes in. Although, of course, our modern legislature has figured ways around the constitutional requirement that the state has a balanced budget. So way back when our Constitution was made, John Adams and the framers of the document understood that the government should only spend equal in proportion to the revenues it receives. In other words, government should not, like what we have a bad tendency to do. We as individuals, we get these things, and we spend more money than we actually make. And as a result, we put ourselves in debt. And if you are in debt, as you know, they apply interest to that debt, which makes the debt even more expensive. Well, John Adams was like, the government shouldn't do that. Government should only spend annually in proportion to the revenues it takes in. But of course, unfortunately, today, laws have been passed that allows the government to fudge the numbers, so to speak. So our state government actually has the ability to borrow. The problem is that the amount of debt that we are in at the state level is twice as much as the actual budget. Which implies that our state government has basically been spending more in its budget than the tax revenue it takes in. Now, the process of making a state budget is complicated. We're going to talk about the municipal budgets when for the final exam. But as far as the state budgeting process, technically it commences every single June. So before the beginning of the new fiscal year. Why does it start in June? Well, the governor receives a report from the legislature. And in that report, it basically shows, at least in theory, I don't know, they don't publish this, so no taxpayer has ever been able to see it. In theory, what the general court should be reporting to the governor is, okay, this is what we spent last fiscal year. This is how much money we have left in the different budget line items, and these are the deficits. Because sometimes you plan on spending money for a certain item, and it comes in more. Sometimes you plan on spending money and it comes in less, just like all of us. Trust me, when you get to be full adults and you leave the nest and you're out on your own, you know, the only way that we can survive as individuals financially is if you plan things. So like my wife and I, we have we allocate a certain amount of percentage of our pay that we estimate we're going to spend on groceries. Well, sometimes you go into the grocery store and they have a sale. And you're going to buy that thing that you didn't plan on buying because it was a sale. But that means you spend more. But there are other times we go into the grocery store, like for instance, we're going to go get fruit or something like that, and it all looks like shit. So we don't buy any fruit. So we spend less. Same is true with the state budget. So in this June report, the governor is in theory supposed to look it over and kind of understand where we stood in order to plan for the next budget. Because obviously if there's certain things that we're underfunding and it's important, we need to put more money there. And vice versa. If there are things that we are not spending, maybe we don't need as much. That report is handled by a special office. That's a division of the governor's office. The Executive Office for Administration and Finance. The EOANF.
All right. So they get the report. Not meaning to be redundant. They look at where they stood last year and they look for shortfalls.
And then this office basically makes proposals for appropriations for the next year.
How much money we need to spend. Now, on or before August 15th,
the EOANF issues its initial projections.
So they've crunched the numbers from last year. And this is essentially the initial estimates of how much money we're going to need to spend to cover the expenses that we foresee. Once this office makes that big number, so let's say this office suggests we're going to spend $50 billion. Once they set upon a number, they then communicate with all of the different state agencies and all of the different departments, cabinet secretaries, ways and means. This is the amount of money we have to spend. What are your needs? Do you think this is going to work? And then the cabinet secretaries, the different departments, the agencies, they all begin filing their budgetary requests.
Each department has the authority to make their budgetary requests. So to bring it more to the municipal level, because it's easier to talk about town structure than it is for the state, because again, we got hundreds of agencies. Well, I suppose I could. So let's say the Park Service, you know, they estimate what they're going to need for the next fiscal year. The state police, the state colleges, you know, they all have the ability to put in these budget requests. Now, there's a flaw in this system. There's a flaw. The biggest flaw is that the agencies and officers in the different departments, they are not told how much money they have to spend. They put their requests in and it gets crammed into the budget. So, classic example, and this is going on in all of the towns. Schools. There's not a municipality in this state, out of all 351, that the local schools are not crushing the town budgets. Because the schools put in their requests for how much money they need. But the town doesn't have the authority to say, we're giving you this much money. So the result is, the school wants more money than the town can afford. So what ends up happening when there's that shortfall? Well, the school is forced to balance its budget somehow. And the only way to balance budgets, because you can't borrow, is you have to cut. You have to cut. When there's not enough money to pay the budget, you have to cut. Now, the tragedy is, or the hypocrisy, I don't know what other word to use, is that the state doesn't have that same limitation. So the towns have to make cuts to balance the budget. The state does not. The state can just raise the appropriations. The state can just decide it's going to spend more money. And by the way, last year's budget at the state level was $55 billion. Well, the governor decided that they're not spending enough money. So guess what this year's budget's going to be? $63 billion.
Because the state has the ability to take more taxes to fill the budget gaps. The towns are capped by Proposition 2.5. So the towns cannot. Unless the voters vote for an override. So if the voters in the town want, they can, bless you, they can basically vote to pay more taxes. But the dirty little secret is that in the towns, if you look at the history of Massachusetts, in different towns' efforts to do overrides, they fail more often than not. Because what voter wants to pay more in taxes? All right. Sorry, got a little sidetracked. But again, it's easier to talk about the towns because if you live in a town and you're paying attention, these are the conversations that are going on. There isn't a city or a town that they're not. All right. Once the rough estimate is there, so you have the estimate on how much the state's going to spend, you have all of these different budgetary requests. The legislature then begins holding open hearings. And each of the department heads, representatives of all the different constitutional officers, so the secretary, the treasurer, the auditor, all of those people, the governor, all of the legislative representatives, the courts, they all begin going into public hearings. And they begin discussing their needs. Or their wants. Basically, they have to explain why they are requesting what they are requesting. These hearings typically take place anywhere from end of August into late October. The data is gathered. The numbers are crunched. And all of the recommendations from the hearings are then forwarded on to the governor's office. Because there are times when different departments try saying they want something, but they may not need it. So maybe the state police say they want to buy 15 new cruisers, 15 of the Ford Explorers that you see out on the Mass Pike. Well, maybe after the hearings, it's determined that they really don't need 15. Maybe they only need 10. You know, so ultimately, the EOANF will scrutinize the requests and then pass those recommendations on to the governor. Because it's the job of the governor to basically make the budget proposal. Question so far. Fast forward from end of October, go into December. After working with the EOANF, the governor would put together a budget, a proposed budget, and will forward that over to the general court. Of course, as we know, anything dealing with money has to originate in the House. But of course, copies are sent to the Senate as well. By law, this submission can take place no later than the fourth Wednesday in January. By law, fourth Wednesday in January. Now, FYI, the reason why the law pushes it that far out, because again, pretty much the governor's ready to do it in December, is don't forget, every 4 years there's an election, which means you have the potential of having a new governor in office. It wouldn't make sense that someone who was newly elected would have to put forward a budget and they didn't have time to at least review it. So, if you have an incumbent or a non-election year, like this year, I think Maura Healey, I think she got her budget proposal in, I think it was like the second week in January. Because again, she's in office. She had the ability to prepare it all. Or her staff did. The governor actually didn't do it. She just puts her name on it. All right. Well, once received, the general court will begin the process of then reviewing it. They may approve of the basic ideas contained in the budget, or they may disapprove in whole or in part. And truth be told, the whole budget is subject to legislative review. What does that mean? Well, very simple. When we did the general court, we saw how a bill becomes a law. The budget actually is formed into a bill, and it goes through the process. The only thing is it starts in the House. So the budget's received. You have to get co-sponsors from both chambers. Typically it's the House Speaker and the Senate President. It then goes into the Rules Committee.
and the Rules Committee makes the schedule. It then gets passed on to the Ways and Means Committee, which deals with all money. They have public hearings. The budget is marked up by Ways and Means. It hits the floor. The members have a chance to debate it, add amendments, tweak, modify. It goes through all three steps of reading. And then once the House is done with it, typically by around now, it then shifts over to the Senate. And then the Senate repeats the process. Typically, every single line item in the budget bill is tweaked, modified by both chambers. Which then means you need to have a conference committee where you have representatives of the House and the Senate, and they sit down and they basically blend a compromise budget together. And if approved, it is regarded as a general appropriations bill, and it's sent to the governor. And just like any bill, the governor can either sign or use a qualified veto, qualified negative veto. If the governor uses a qualified veto on the general appropriations bill, it goes back to both chambers, and they start the debate again, and they possibly override the governor's veto. It's just like any other law. We covered it already.
But here is the interesting thing. In fiscal year 2013, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts passed a budget that was $32 billion, of which $22 billion was from state taxes and $13 billion was from federal grants and operating transfers, etc.
This current year, the governor is proposing a budget of $63 billion. But here's the catch. About $48 billion will come from state taxes, state revenue. But the federal government may not fill all of the estimated funding because of politics. Because the governors of this state, as well as the legislature, is not complying with federal law. So I don't know what's going to happen this late spring, early summer, if the governor agrees to the budget as it currently is proposed, and the Trump administration turns around and tells Massachusetts to go pound sand. Plus, another thing that the state is dealing with is a revenue loss. 140,000 people have moved out of Massachusetts in the last 5 years. In this last year alone, it's estimated that Massachusetts is suffered a loss of $4 billion. People are leaving. Companies are leaving. People don't want to live here. This is not a taxpayer-friendly state. So I do not know what's going to happen this summer. This is the first time
where we may be, not quite bankrupt, but the governor may actually have to chop the proposed budget down. Because I don't think we have the ability to borrow enough to make up for that loss. Or alternatively, you know what they're going to do? They're going to try to raise taxes. They're going to try to raise fees. So just pay attention, because your ability to live in Massachusetts may get that more challenging. Oh, one last point. FYI, the biggest cost driver of our budget is health and human services. Health and human services. Roughly, I don't know, 60% of our state budget is because of medical expenses and other social services. The second largest chunk goes to free college and other public education. So what's one of the things that could change? Well, if there's not enough money, the governor may have to reverse what she did last year when she made, like, quid pro quo free. Tuition might have to come back. Can't afford it. Or maybe they'll close community colleges. Because if there's not enough money, like I said, the only way to close the budget, either borrow or you make cuts. So this is going to have a real life impact on you. So just be attentive. Pay attention. Because the last thing you want to do is get blindsided. Questions? All right. And of course, the law that's passed becomes the Annual Appropriations Act. And I already talked about the numbers. So if passed, the next one will be the Annual Appropriations Act of fiscal year 2027. All right, no questions? I'm going to flip. All right, the next area is with the bureaucracy. So we understand what the bureaucracy is in general. We understand how the bureaucracy is paid for with the budget. And now what happens if you choose to work for the Commonwealth? Well, there are large differences in getting a government job, becoming a public employee, than becoming a private employee. So if you want to go to McDonald's and get a job working at McDonald's, you pretty much got to go in and fill out an application, and the manager's going to decide whether they want to give you a job or not. Well, if you choose to work for the state, it's very different depending upon the position that you are applying for. It's kind of like no duh. One of the most challenging aspects is whether or not the state job falls under the civil service laws. Under the civil service laws. FYI, the civil service law can be found in Chapter 31 of the Massachusetts General Laws. All of the rules and regulations of the civil service are published online and viewable, again, under Chapter 31. And who falls under the civil service? Teachers, policemen, firefighters, librarians, doctors that work at the state hospitals, nurses that work at the state hospitals, the secretaries that work in the governor's office, the members of the general court, their staff members, and the employees, judges,
people who work for MassDOT. All of those employees are civil servants. And the law establishes all of the rules in terms of their qualifications and what's necessary to get a job. Now, the civil service system itself is not unique to Massachusetts.
The civil service system was actually implemented in the United States after the political shenanigans of the 19th century was causing complications for government, both at the state and federal levels. The whole idea behind the civil service system is a meritocracy. Meaning, to get a job, you have to be qualified. So this eliminates arbitrary decisions. Like nepotism. You know, you are a state employee and your cousin's looking for a job. You know, your cousin just can't get a job because you work there. You know, they may work at McDonald's, but that's not going to work for the state. Because your cousin may be a freaking idiot. They may be functionally illiterate. So to put it another way, it's not who you know, but it's what you know. Some civil service jobs require degrees. An associate's degree, a bachelor's degree. Some require certifications. Some require passing tests. It's all established by law. Because the old way of doing it was commonly referred to as the spoils system. Spoils system. Now, FYI, the phrase spoils system is attributed with President Andrew Jackson. He became president of these United States in a highly contested and charged election in 1828. Andrew Jackson is the founder of the Democrat Party because they broke away from the Jeffersonian Republicans after what Jackson called the corrupt bargain of 1824, when John Quincy Adams won. Even though Andrew Jackson had more votes. So, Jackson formed the Democrat Party, recruited Democrats, and managed to win the office in 1828. And when he got into office, one of his staff members famously said, "To the victor goes the spoils." To the victor goes the spoils. Jackson literally fired all of the federal government employees that were hired by his predecessor and fill them with Democrat loyalists. People who had voted for him. People who had campaigned for him. People who had donated money to him. And on top of that, he began making new government jobs.
to put more of his friends in.
Well, this system went on for 60 years.
And if you track the growth of the federal bureaucracy, like when Jackson became president, there might have been 20 to 30,000 federal employees. But by 1880, it grew to 300,000. And all of these jobs were filled along party lines. So not because they were qualified, just because they were loyal. And I kid you not, people literally got paychecks to go sit in an office somewhere. So you didn't have to do anything. You just got checks. The only catch was you had to give a portion of your paycheck back to the party. So if a Democrat gave you a job, you had to give, like, I think it was like 20 or 30% of your paycheck back to the party. And if you did that, you could keep your job, which required you to do nothing. Well, post-Civil War, Reconstruction, 1860s, 1870s, a lot of people started complaining about this system. Because what happens if you had a government job and you were actually qualified and could actually do the job, but you were the wrong party? Well, you'd get fired. Just because of your party affiliation. But here's the dirty little secret. Government usually doesn't react unless death is involved. Death is the big motivator. When people die, it's amazing how quickly government can act. Well,
in 1881,
a man by the name of Charles Couteau assassinated President James Garfield on the railroad station in Washington, D.C. Gateau was a loyal party member who was delusional. And he believed the only reason why Garfield won was because of what he did out on the campaign trail for Garfield. So he actually demanded that Garfield make him the ambassador of France. Now, the funny thing is back then, there was limited security at the White House. So if you wanted to, you could just travel down to New York, Washington, D.C., go into the White House, wait out in the lobby, and at some point during the day, you could have a face-to-face meeting with the president. Well, apparently, Gateau went down there several times, had a couple of meetings with Garfield, and Garfield basically said, sorry, I'm not going to give you the job. So Gateau was pissed. He wanted revenge for the slight. Another weird thing that they used to do is the Washington, D.C. papers used to print the president's itinerary. Almost minute by minute, what the president was going to do every day, where he was going to be, where he was going to go. So on the day Gateau shot Garfield, it was actually in the newspaper, it was public knowledge, that Garfield was going to get in a train, and he was going to travel to New York, and he was going to meet with the son of Abraham Lincoln, who was his Secretary of War. So Garfield sit on the platform, Gateau comes up with a pistol, pulls it out of his coat, fires a bunch of rounds into Garfield's chest. They managed to get the bullets out, but they couldn't clean the wound. And the poor guy died of sepsis, an infection. Painful way to go, a few days later. Well, after it reached the press, that Gateau killed Garfield because he didn't get a job, all of the politicians suddenly said, holy cow, we could die if we don't give our loyalists jobs. So they push forward with this civil service system.
FYI, the first civil service law was passed by the federal government in 1882. The first state to pass a law was New York, 1883. Massachusetts was the second state. We passed our civil service law in 1884. And it's been on the books ever since. Fast forward.
From 1884 all the way up until the early 1980s, the civil service system pretty much remained unchanged.
But beginning in the 1880s, there was efforts to begin tweaking the civil service system.
Why? Well, the state wanted to put more jobs in.
One of the most significant changes was teachers.
Prior to 1993, the teachers were not part of the civil service system. They were town employees. So it was up to the towns to determine what qualifications you had to be a teacher. So here's the funny thing. If any of you ever think of wanting to be a teacher, or think about being a teacher, if you could get a job in like the 1970s, you could potentially get a teaching job with a high school diploma or an associate's degree. But after 1993, when the teachers were added to the civil service system, the state imposed requirements that apply to all teachers in Massachusetts. Even though they're employed by the towns, it became state rules. I would not want to ever. I used to be a classroom teacher. I taught in the late 1990s. Taught public schools for about 5 years in a past life. I kind of accidentally fell into teaching. It's not really where I wanted to go because I was doing other things. But when I started teaching, I actually had a master's degree. And then I went out and I got what at the time was called a generalist certification. So I could teach any subject in middle school, which was kind of funny because I did graduate with, I had almost 2 master's degrees in history and political science. Because I was at the time I was thinking about going becoming a lawyer. It just didn't happen until later. But anyways, so I had this generalist certification because that was what was initially allowed. I went to school for history. 1 year I taught computers. 1 year I taught English Language Arts. I think it was called ELA then. I don't know what it's called now. No, it was just Language Arts. It wasn't English Language, it was just Language Arts. 1 year I taught, like, algebra. I actually taught chemistry 1 year. I didn't know that stuff. But truth be told, I was smarter than a middle schooler. So, back then, you didn't have to be, like, highly educated. Well, the civil service system for teachers continued to evolve. And today, it's really, really complicated. You have to pass the Massachusetts Teachers Test. I didn't need to do that. And to pass the Massachusetts Teachers Test, you have to be highly knowledgeable in all subjects to the college level. So if you, for instance, want to teach early education, kindergarten, preschool, teach kids how to color in the lines, you have to know, like, AP chemistry. You also cannot get full tenure unless you have a master's degree. And you have to renew your teacher's license I don't know what it is now. I don't know if it's every 3 years or every 5 years. And the only way you can renew your teacher's license is if you get continuing education credits. So you constantly have to go back to school. If you don't, under state law, you will be terminated. You could be a great teacher, but if you don't follow the civil service regulations, you're out.
Now, why do they do that?
Well, when the legislature made the law, they thought this was the best way to make highly capable, educated teachers. But of course, one of the things that I saw when I was actually teaching, and I know what my kids had to deal with when they were in school, and I'm sure you all had to deal with it when you were in school, is that just because somebody has a bunch of degrees doesn't mean they actually can teach.
Plus, to play devil's advocate,
it's also part of the problem why the schools are more expensive. Because the more education credits the teachers get, the more their salary increases. So to keep their jobs, they have to keep going back to school whether they want to or not. When they go back to school, they get more credits, and when they get more credits, they get more money.
So the system itself is almost designed to fail. And it's a tragedy.
By the way, the rules are the same for all civil service jobs. To be a firefighter, I only started with teachers because I went through it. But to be a firefighter, in order to be a firefighter, even if you want to be a volunteer firefighter, technically it's on call. You have to go to the fire academy and have close to 300 hours of training in before you're allowed to set foot on a truck. And then, once you do that, you're also required annually to complete upwards of 200 hours of training. So that's one of the reasons why a lot of the towns are shifting from on-call fire departments to professional full-time departments. Because nobody who back in the day would want to volunteer just to help out, because they're civic-minded, community-oriented, most of them have jobs, they have families, they can't afford to do all the training. But state law establishes the rules, and you have to comply. FYI, in Sutton, the current age of our on-call fire department is 52. That's the average age. So in 10 years, it's very likely that Sutton will not have any firefighters. Because if you were living in town in the 80s, all you had to do was just show up at the fire department and say, I want to volunteer. And you would get whatever training you needed in the department. But state reform took that away.
Police,
same thing. Under the civil service laws, they're required to do trainings, professional development.
All of the rules established by law. On one hand, it's good. Learning, training is never a bad thing. But again, it's very, very cumbersome.
All right, enough with trying to make it real. Under our civil service law in Massachusetts, there are two broad categories of employees that fall under the civil service laws.
There are the people who are in the official service. The official service.
Official services are those positions that have some type of managerial authority.
Meaning, they have the ability to make decisions, enforce compliance. There are also
people who fall under the labor service. The labor service.
These are individuals that, well, as the name implies, that tend to be the worker bees.
So, to give you an example here, I, as your esteemed professor, are technically classified as being under the official service. Campus police officers, also official service. But the grounds crew, guys that go around and cut the grass, and the custodial staff, they all fall under the labor service.
What's the distinction? Well,
the authority that's given, the responsibilities, but also the requirements. So, if you want to become a campus police officer, you have to, for instance, get your gun license. But if you're going to be a member of the grounds crew, you know, maybe you have to go and get a heavy equipment operator license. Each division has their own rules and regulations.
Now, here's the thing, though.
Not all state employees fall under the civil service umbrella. The upper echelon are exempted from the civil service. So, for example, in our local police department, Sutton PD, all of our patrolmen and our sergeants fall under the civil service laws. But our lieutenant and our chief do not. So what does that mean? Here's the weird thing. Technically speaking, you could become the chief of police without ever having been a cop. Whereas, to become a patrolman or woman, you have to go to a police academy. You have to pass the police academy. You have to engage in certain trainings. You have to pass an exam. Now, truth be told, I don't know any police department that would not want, as a chief, somebody who was on the beat, so to speak. Someone who was actually a cop. But under the law, they don't have to be.
So there may be circumstances out there where we've had chiefs of police in some of our communities that were actually never cops before. Our current chief of police,
we won the lottery with Tom Caloro, our chief of police. He was a city cop in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, for 20 years, rising the rank to lieutenant chief. And he was also 25 years of military service, combat Marine, and then after he did three tours in the Marines, he switched over to the Air Force, where he spent 20 years in the Rhode Island Air Force Reserves or National Guard. So, you know, our chief is he's a man's man. He's a cop, but he's also military. So, you know, he's whipping our department in line, making him follow all the rules and regulations, and he's an all-around great guy.
Hopefully the same can be said about the chiefs of police in your town, or the fire department as well, because those are very, very important individuals.
All right, so what happens if you want to become a nurse, or you want to become a teacher, or you want to become a cop? Civil service laws require you to take tests.
And of course, the tests are tailored to the position. So, for example, if you want to become a cop, you have to pass a three-part exam that has
different written areas. You passed the written exam? Oh, congratulations. What's up next for you? Physical test? Oh, yeah. Outstanding. Outstanding. Yeah, that's a good job. Well done. Yeah, so you take the written test, you're going to have to take the physical exam, and then you're also going to have to do other things. Like, you have to qualify. You know, firearms. I think you have, there's a driving component as well. So it's not an easy thing to do.
That's awesome. That's awesome. But here's the catch. Now, your name is on a list.
An eligibility list. So, if there is an opening,
and you apply,
once you complete all of it, when there's an opening at a police department, the police department has access to the civil service lists, and by law, they are supposed to take the top scoring applicants who apply for their positions.
So, what ends up happening? Well, again, by law,
they have to narrow down the applicants to the top three applicants.
And then each of those three are interviewed, and one of them ultimately gets hired. Because that's the openings.
Now, here's the thing. If there are two openings, you only have to take four. If there are three openings, you only have to take five.
Why? I don't know. That's what state law says. Now, by the way, the only ones who get special treatment under Chapter 31 are veterans or disabled veterans. By default, they are ranked at the top of the list.
So if you serve your country, regardless of what you got on the test, they place you higher because you actually receive training in the military above and beyond what you're going to get to be a cop.
Or a firefighter, or whatnot.
Now, under the civil service system, even if you get a job, you get hired. It's not permanent. Under the civil service laws, you are placed on a probationary period for 6 months. Except for fire and police. Their probationary period is a year.
What does that mean? Well,
once you are hired, you can get hired as a cop without actually going through the academy, just taking the test. But you have a year's time to complete the academy.
And do the other components. But to be honest with you, if you don't go to the academy first, chances are you're not going to get a job because there are so many other candidates that did. During this period, any hiree can be terminated.
They can be terminated. Without reason, without cause.
And
all the individual needs to receive is just an explanation that their efforts are not satisfactory. Of course, the termination has to be filed. It all gets recorded in the civil service system. Because if you have someone, for instance, that gets a job as a firefighter, and they actually can't do the job of firefighting, under state law, you don't want to expose other departments to that applicant. Now, if it's a personality issue, that's a different story. So we had a kid. Oh my God, this kid would have been a freaking superstar. Came in and got hired as a cop. And he also was fully trained as a firefighter. So he was perfect because we have a small town. So if there was an emergency, he was licensed and qualified to do both positions. But he didn't get along with the lieutenant. Our previous lieutenant was kind of a bully. So he basically quit. Well, that had to get filed in his record. But because it was personality, not qualifications, he had a job like 2 weeks later. Because what I do as a selectman, I try to get to know all of our cops and our firefighters, just, you know, I don't want to say personal level, but at least professional level. Because, you know, I want to know about them. I want to know about their experience. I want to be able to support them. So, he actually asked if I would use me for a reference. And I said, sure, why not? He was a good kid. And he ended up getting a job in 2 weeks after he left. So the fact that there was that personality clash didn't impact him. But we've also had to let cops go in the first year just because they weren't good cops. And to my knowledge, I don't think any of them got jobs after that. So be warned. If you're going to go out and be a police officer, make sure you know what you're doing and you do it the right way. Because your career's at stake. If you make it past the trial period, you fall into what is known as tenure. Good behavior tenure. Obviously, if you show up drunk at the work, you know, you'll get fired. But under the civil service laws, there's strict procedures in place. So, under state law, to get fired if you have tenure, you have to get annual evaluations. And if you get a bad evaluation in 1 year, you have a whole nother year to fix it. And you have to get notice of everything that you're doing wrong. You get due process. And if you make even the most small gains of improvements, technically you get a whole nother year. What am I saying? Well, under civil service laws, it takes up to 3 years to fire somebody because of the protections that they receive. So that's the reason why you've had, for instance, bad teachers. Because it's impossible to get rid of them. Now, if they assaulted a student, that's a different scenario. That's bad behavior. The contract allows them to be terminated. But if they're just incompetent, that's not enough to get fired as a teacher in Massachusetts. It's amazing. Oh, by the way, teachers don't get tenure for 3 years. Just FYI. Now, what happens if it's a temporary position? Well, if you get hired on a temporary position, there is no tenure clock. So sometimes schools will need to fill a temporary vacancy because a staff member, you know, gave birth to a child or is out on medical. Well, they will have long-term substitutes. They don't get tenure. They're only there for whatever that time period is. State law does allow for emergency appointments. Emergency appointment can be made to allow someone who is unqualified for the position, but usually it's on the condition that they do whatever is necessary to become qualified. So I know of years and years and years ago, back when I was a public school teacher, the school was desperately in need of someone to teach, I think it was biology 1 year. And they couldn't, no one was applying for the job. And it was like 2 weeks before the school year started. So the principal hired one of the substitutes who did not complete her degree just to get a body into the classroom. But the deal was is that if she didn't, because she only had to take like two more classes. If she didn't complete the classes by the end of the school year, you know, she'd be fired. But if she completed the classes, she could get another year and then she would have a year to take the teacher's test.
So the law does carve out exceptions.
What happens if you want to be promoted? Well, under the civil service, if you want to go from a patrolman to a sergeant, or if you want to go from a teacher to a principal, then you have to take another test.
I've already talked about renewals. Removals, it's all spelled out in the law. Unions.
Most civil service jobs in Massachusetts are protected by unions. Public employees are allowed to organize and engage in collective bargaining. Essentially, you give up a portion of your paycheck to be part of this little team, then the team hires people to go demand more wages, better benefits, and so forth. Municipal unions suck. They really do, from a selectman's perspective. Because do you think the teachers' union wanted to help the town balance the budget? No! Teachers union wants more money. Do you think the police union wants to help the towns balance the budget? No! They want more money. But it makes it easier to negotiate as a group than it does as an individual. Because what happens if you're not good at your job? You might not get a raise. But if you're part of a union, the union's going to protect you. Because everyone gets the say. Of course, the problem with that is it makes it real, it doesn't really make it worthwhile to stand out. You know, being part of a union, you don't have to work hard and stand out. Try to, you know, achieve success. Because whether you're good or bad, the union's going to protect you just the same.
Now, union activity, I got one more click after this.
Union activity is regulated by state law, and under Massachusetts, it's actually illegal to strike. Now, there have been some teachers' unions that have gone out on strike. Most recently, it was the teachers' union in Newton. Well, under state law, the union got penalized. Every day they were not working, to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. Now, what's the big deal? Well, each of the union members puts a portion of their paycheck into the union's bank account. And they use that bank account to hire, you know, negotiators to work out future contracts. Well, the teachers' union in Newton, I think they were on strike for like 15 days or something like that. State charged them hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it pretty much drained that union's bank account. So because of those actions, the union's ability to represent its members was basically crushed for the future. Collective bargaining, I've already talked about that,
but that's... And last but not least, ethics.
This is the last click, ethics. State law, chapter 268...
Is the conduct of a public officials and employees law.
Very simple, this law basically tells us the behavior that we can engage in and the behavior that we cannot. So for instance, if I take a bribe from any of you to give you an A, that would be a violation of the ethics law. Because under the ethics law, I'm not allowed to do anything in a quid pro quo fashion. Also, I'm not allowed to receive gifts more than $25. I'm also not allowed to like help friends and family members get jobs or to do contracts. The most interesting thing about the ethics law, and this is going to be the last point, is if you become a state employee, every single year you have to get recertified in your knowledge of the ethics law. You have to take an online test, get a nice little certificate. And it applies to the state or the local levels if you're in the civil service. Questions? Exam today. No one ever does that. Exam tomorrow. Exam Saturday. Exam Sunday. Sunday it is. You lost on all of them. I'm sorry. You're trying. All right. I'll send the reminder. It's going to cover the governor, the executive, the courts, the bureaucracy. It'll open up at 8 a.m., closes at midnight. Please do not forget. See y'all on Tuesday. Tuesday. Yeah, I'm going to do that today. As soon as I got out of here, I was actually out on the road. I didn't get home till like midnight. But yes, I will make sure it's there for you.